sleep, Mom. Come on, go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories! Okay, listen, you can get involved in the show. It's wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. That's how this works. You send us letters, we answer them. We do a little research for you, like this one.
Yes.
And also, I like it when you start with the nice words. This one starts with nice words. I love the podcast. It keeps me occupied during a long work day. First of all, let me say, happy that we're hanging out with you at work.
And I like how this next sentence ends.
The next sentence says, there is a story that always interested me about Eddie Money accidentally snorting laundry detergent.
Right. So the first sentence starts really nice. It's the end sort of a thing. And now we're actually back into the rock and roll rumor and innuendo, which is, did Take Me Home Tonight Eddie Money snort laundry detergent?
Laundry detergent. Have you ever snorted laundry detergent?
That's a no. Or the pods.
I was going to say, do they? I know very little about today's youth and their drug use. My drug understandings are a little dated. The Tide Pod thing happened, and I was very confused as to what that even meant.
No, it was like, I guess it was pandemic fun that we missed out on because we're older and we're having.
My pandemic fun was gardening.
Oh.
I learned to cook during the pandemic. I did not snort laundry detergent.
Oh, I had booze delivered to my house in my above ground pool.
Yeah.
That's what I
forgot about the above ground pool. Did you get rid of that?
Yeah, but we had a backup. We had a backup one.
So do you have one currently?
We do have a backup one that's not up.
Oh, that's not up. Got you. Okay. So is that going to go up this summer? Are we having pool parties? Are we having Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories pool parties?
It might be next summer.
Okay.
But we've kept it.
Listen, you're really tempting us all.
It's a rectangle. And not a circle. That's what's weird.
Like, does that make it more bougie?
Well, no, it's just because the other one was so freaking big and round, and this is like really long and rectangly.
Okay.
You know, that's the
shape of our pools. They say men don't talk about things that are substantial.
But Ryan,
we're proving them wrong.
Ryan wanted to know more about Eddie Money.
Yeah, he says, I'd love to hear more about this. And then he ends this again. This is just a good letter in how to communicate with us because of our egos. He ends the letter with, thanks for producing my favorite podcast.
Thank you, Ryan.
You're welcome, sir. You're welcome.
And this is a good question because Eddie does have, you know, Eddie's deceased, but Eddie did have a reputation for stuff.
For being sort of wild, right?
For snorting things and for definitely being on the fun side of rock and roll.
Very fun. Okay, so this is interesting to me because normally when we get these sorts of questions, we find out that the rumor has way overshot the severity of whatever grain of truth is actually involved, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So usually my response is like, okay, this has been blown a little out of proportion. What really happened is X. But this time, my response is, actually, it's way worse than laundry detergent.
Right. We're going to explain, Ryan, we're going to explain how it's worse than laundry detergent.
Yeah,
we'll get there. But there's all kinds of little stops around the way, walking through the garden.
We've got to talk about Eddie.
Yeah.
Eddie Money.
And the other things that he did that were possibly dangerous as well.
Okay, so let me clarify my response a little. I've not been able to find a story or even much of a rumor of a story about Eddie and laundry detergent. Nothing's coming up in any of my research. But there is a well-documented story that got close to defining him for a little while that involves snorting, but it's snorting something else entirely. And so I'm thinking that this might be, Ryan, where the rumor that you've heard comes from. I think it actually originated with this and then evolved into something way less dangerous as opposed to devolving into, I don't know. Anyway, this is what I think it's all rooted in.
Snorting substances. I love Eddie Money.
Yeah.
And I didn't grow up with Eddie Money because he was older when I was younger, but he
just didn't seem cool in the mid-80s?
He was on MTV, but he was already an older guy.
Oh, yeah.
But those songs were like immediate.
And the way he was imaged, he was like, especially after the first couple records, yeah, he just seemed sort of like an older dude. And we'll talk about these two areas of his career, because you're sort of talking about the second part of his career when he comes back.
Right, the part that people know.
Right. Sure. What's really interesting is that these two big peaks are separated by this valley, and that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about, right? It's the entrance into the valley. That's where we're headed.
Right. And the distinction has two big songs. So the first period of Eddie's career is Two Tickets to Paradise. And the second one,
Pack My Bags and I'll Leave Tonight.
The second one is Take Me Home Tonight, which was confusing for me when I first heard it, because I didn't understand why the refrain for Be My Baby was in Take Me Home Tonight.
What's happening?
And then I would see her on Letterman for Christmas, and everything was confusing. It was like Andy Kaufman, Jerry Lawler. I got the wrestling reference in. So,
well done.
Yeah, you're welcome. But anyway, Take Me Home Tonight is my favorite Eddie Money song.
Right. Okay. So this is a really good point. We need to do some history on Eddie Money first, though, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that starts by saying that the one thing about Eddie, and we sort of said this up top, is that he's defined by being larger than life. He's always, like, I like it. You said I like Eddie, but I didn't grow up with him. I like Eddie because I like enthusiasm. It's one of my favorite things in life.
Yeah.
And this dude knew how to be enthusiastic about everything.
Yeah, and he had it just kind of, you know, in spades, like coming on stage as a performer, as a person and everything. So his name's not Eddie Money.
No way.
It's Eddie Mahoney. And so he took a couple of letters out of his name when he decided for a stage name.
I actually read that he got that idea because friends would mock him for not having money. They call him Eddie No Money. Eddie Mahoney.
Right.
Which he then turns into his own punchline for future interviews. And this is a great example of what I mean by being larger than life. He takes these little nuggets and then he like makes them part of his story. And so there's this quote later in his career. He says, "When I first changed my name to Eddie Money, I was so broke I was thinking of also changing my first name to Owen."
Owen Money. Owen Money. That's what it was. Owen Money.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. What it does seem to be how it goes with a guy. There's little biographical details that he'll flaunt throughout his career that'll keep up this image of Crazy Eddie Money, right?
Crazy Eddie.
For instance, he said he got kicked out of high school because he forged a report card.
Did you ever do that?
I didn't do anything like that till college.
Did you ever forge your mother's signature on something?
No.
Okay.
I never did that.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't either, but no one's surprised by that.
No. I figured out in college how to not have my grades be sent home. I took care of, like...
Oh, I remember you telling me that. Didn't you do that after they got sent home one time?
Yeah, and it was like, why do you have a B in statistics? And I was like, I'll show you guys a B in statistics.
Okay, so another one of these factoids, these larger-than-life factoids that he weaves into his narrative. He says that when he told his dad that he was going to try to make it as a musician, his dad tore his Jimi Hendrix poster off the wall of his bedroom, which is a nice, colorful flourish, right? And this doesn't stop with his pre-music biography. He carries this type of swagger into talking about the songs that he performs as well.
Right. And so here's Eddie's story about the backstory for Two Tickets to Paradise. Right? So what is that song about? So this is a quote from Eddie. The entire quote, this is Eddie explaining the song. Quote, "Well, I was going with this girl at the time. She was in college, and I was in college, and her mother wanted her to meet someone that was actually making a living. She had been dating the mayor's son, and I didn't have any money to take her to Bermuda or Hawaii or anything like that. So I wanted to take her on a Greyhound bus ride to the California Redwoods. Romance. It would only cost maybe $62 for the both of us, but she dumped me. It never happened. But who knows?" End quote. That's his story.
What I love about this is that these two tickets, in my mind, when I think about Two Tickets to Paradise, they're airplane tickets.
Right.
In his mind, they're Greyhound bus tickets.
It's like the super bus. It's like, you're going to take the super bus to Detroit.
Hey, baby, I got two tickets. Oh, cool. To that concert? No, it's to a lecture on art. Okay. So we mentioned his dad, right? His dad tearing stuff off his wall. And his granddad, and his brother, all police officers.
Right.
And to hear him tell it, Eddie tried to follow. This is another thing in his biography throughout his career. He will tell this story. I watched during the research of this tons of interviews from throughout his career. So from the beginning to the end, he consistently told the same stories. He would, you know, that Two Tickets to Paradise story changes a little bit. This story changes a little bit. But basically it is that he was going to become a cop like his family. He starts to get into it and basically gets relegated to like doing menial work. And then he also, the reason he says he doesn't follow it is not the menial work, but because they wouldn't let him grow his hair long.
Shake it!
Sorry. Yeah.
Snap it. Now, he will always be a New York guy. Everyone does because of the accent and the everything he says. He's born in Manhattan. He lives in Long Island, but he goes in California. That's where he goes to make music and be famous.
Since we're talking about California and where he goes specifically, have we ever talked about the Winterland Ballroom on this show before?
Not specifically, but it's an amazing historic venue that opened in the 20s. It was an ice skating rink.
This is so cool.
That was converted into a seated venue. Zeppelin played Whole Lotta Love there first. I looked that up just because I thought that was awesome. Yeah.
Like, that was the first time they ever played it?
Uh-huh.
Was in the Winterland?
In that venue.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I like to imagine that Robert Plant was ice skating while he did that.
You need... Hold on. He
hit those notes because he was freaking out. He just hit the ice.
But the real connection here is it's Bill Graham. That's sort of what we want to connect with, too.
You know, you mentioned Bill Graham, and I just have to share that I was in Vegas over the weekend. And you're currently in Vegas, the Sphere is up and operating. And, you know, U2 opened the Sphere, but now Dead and Company are playing in the Sphere. So I, in a few hours in Vegas, met more Grateful Dead fans, saw more Grateful Dead t-shirts than I ever have in my entire life up to this point. There were so many. Even you go to the airport, and they're all... And here's what I love about Grateful Dead fans. Shouts to our Grateful Dead fans in the audience. I know we have plenty of them, including Charles from Texas, who writes the show often. Shouts to you, buddy. They are proud. Like, you don't... You get up in the morning, and you're like, how do I tell the world who my favorite band is? And you dress in order to do that. And I respect the hell out of that.
Yeah.
That's pretty freaking sweet, man.
I do want to tell you something kind of opposite, weird. So a friend of mine went to Vegas, and it was the same time that Fish had those, like, just a very limited number of shows at the Sphere. And he said there was, like, during the day he met all these Fish fans, and everybody was, like, so super cool. And, like, he's not a Fish fan, but he was, like, talking to people, like, seeing where they're from or whatever. And then they went out and did a whole bunch of stuff, and they went and played slots, and I think they went to a Cirque show or something, and they came back to the hotel, and it was like 4 a.m. And he said that group of people had a very different vibe and language and look on their faces from earlier than the day. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, it looks like they all were from like the sixth dimension, and they'd been snorting Dilaudid for like 6 hours. Like, no one could like talk, and everything was like, everyone, like people, it was like watching Hunter S. Thompson, like in the movie, like Johnny Depp, when they're trying to walk into the hotel. Like,
no, none of that surprises me.
No.
But again, Fish fans also very adamant about their love for Fish, and I respect the hell out of it. Back to the Winterland Ballroom. Okay, so this place is mostly just doing theater and review shows at first, and then they do opera, and they do boxing, and they do tennis. This is before Bill Graham gets involved. But in the 1960s, when he does get involved, he starts renting the venue and putting on rock shows. And this holds, just to give you, this is always my nerdy question when I talk about venues with people, how big was it? How many people are in the shows? So it holds like 5,400 people.
Right. That makes it bigger than the Fillmore West, which is like the more famous venue out there.
Good. Good.
And it makes it more valuable to Bill, especially after the Fillmore West closes. So he will do shows there for about a decade in the late 70s. Pretty much everyone in the universe we could list played there.
The list is amazing.
It's silly, but they close in 78 is when that venue closes.
But he does more than just these shows with big acts. Once he starts to take this on as his venue of choice, he also will do shows for up-and-coming acts. And so he designs this show called Sounds of the City, and it's like essentially an open mic. And they tape it for him so he can see everybody that plays his show. And I guess this is like a thing people know. because when Eddie shows up, he's got some songs written, and he's got this band called the New Rockets, and he gets a slot on one of these shows, and so he shows up with a whole bunch of his buddies in the audience.
And this is a quote. It was a rainy Tuesday night, and I had everybody come up close to the stage so it looked like the place was a little bit more crowded than it was.
And that's a trick that I have done many times in my promotional life, promoting rock shows and events. You remember doing this in radio where we'd be like, everybody, there's 30 people here, but we need all 30 people to crowd into this corner, and that's when we're going to take a picture.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sure. Look at what we did here.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. So this video, this trick works on this video. It finally does get Graham to check out Eddie Money. He had some help him get a deal with Columbia Records.
And the relationship between Eddie and Bill becomes important. They get close. And it to illustrate what the association will become between Bill and Eddie, Eddie says that when Bill died in 1991, the way he finds out that Bill Graham's dead is that CNN shows up at his house, knocks on the door, and asks for a quote.
That's wild to me that they were that close and that that's the association that Bill Graham has. I mean, I think Grateful Dead, but CNN thought Eddie Money, right? So yeah. It should be made clear that Eddie Money and Columbia Records and Bill Graham, this does not happen overnight. Like, we sort of skipped from, hey, he moved from New York, he went to California, here's the Winterland Ballroom, and here's Eddie Money with a record deal. But that takes like a decade.
Yeah, we're in the 70s right here.
Yeah, Eddie gets to California in 68. That first record on Columbia drops in 77. So there's 9 years that happen. And during this time, Eddie is not just being a vagrant or even just being a musician. He goes to school, first at UC Berkeley, and then community college, and there, because I guess the stakes are lower, he starts taking a variety of classes, and he gets interested in taking music classes. And while he's doing that, he then is like, hey, this is a marketable thing I can take into the Bay Area clubs, and he starts playing nightclubs.
And part of Eddie's swagger is to tell the story of a success in a way that downplays all the work.
Right.
That he puts into it. Like,
yeah, he really acts like it's just like, oh, and then one time they gave me a record deal, but like he works on it hard.
Yeah, he acts like he lucked into everything, that success was a thing he fell into. But what Eddie actually does is take college music courses. And then Eddie, this is a great story. He takes vocal lessons, and not from your Aunt Hilda in the neighborhood.
Now, when people say vocal lessons, I assume some eccentric woman with a piano and a tutu is like, let me teach you.
Yeah.
That's not what happens to Eddie. So, first of all, let me say, I was watching a 2011 acoustic performance. So he's in his 60s during this performance. A Paste magazine feature. It's in the show notes. It's really good. It's actually Bill Graham related. But I was struck by how solid his voice was, even that close to the end of his life, which was still 10 years off from when he died. But it comes out like, it's sort of just, you take it for granted. It just sounds like a New York guy singing, and he can carry a tune. But when the other guys that are playing with him harmonize with him, you're like, oh man, this dude can do this. And so this can be traced back, his ability to really sing and harmonize and stuff, to these lessons he has, as you mentioned, with Judy Frickin' Davis.
So she's an amazing behind the scenes figure in music, Brian. I want to discuss
good.
Here.
She's so good.
She has this huge impact. No name recognition.
No name recognition. There's a bunch of these people who are going to come up in this episode specifically who are giant influencers who you're not going to know their names, and that's fine. But let us educate you on them because it's fascinating stuff. So here's the deal with Judy. She was essentially a fixer. Like, if you it screwed up your voice, or if you couldn't quite figure out how to use it correctly, you would get sent to Judy if you were of a certain pedigree or had the access or the money or whatever. And when I say people, here's a short list. Frank Sinatra, Barbara Streisand, Grace Slick, Steve Perry of Journey. They all go to this woman. So imagine, when else are you ever going to find a list of those people with Eddie Money next to them?
No one.
You're never going to see Sinatra, Streisand, Eddie Money. Like, that does not typically happen unless you're talking about Judy Davis's client list, which I think is absolutely fascinating. There's this amazing, this is a total side note, but if you just like to go deeper into our episodes, there's a piece that has nothing to do with what we're talking about from 1962 in the show notes. And it chronicles a visit that a 22-year-old Barbara Streisand has with Judy. And it's a really insightful read into both women. So if you want to learn more about her, check that out. It's in the show notes.
So bottom line, Eddie works his ass off to get his skills and his songs to the right form and place. So in 77, everything starts to click into place. Cue part one of Eddie's career.
Part one. Okay, funny side conversation I wanted to have with you before we went much farther. Do you think of Eddie as a sex symbol?
Fuck yeah, I do.
You do?
Right.
Okay, talk me through this.
I'm saying I don't personally, when I was watching him as a kid, didn't think I find Eddie attractive.
But you think other people thought he was hot.
I thought there has to be a way to where he would be on stage and he probably would mouth over to a roadie and go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, red, and be like, oh, the girl in the red t-shirt. Like, I just figured he was one of those guys who, like, women just absolutely love because of the swagger and the hair and the outfit.
I mean, you're pointing out all things that I think do play into the sex appeal that he apparently does have.
Like an anti-crooner?
Kinda.
Right, he's not a crooner, but he's like a crooner, a crooner.
There is a crooner quality. And again, Frank Sinatra's vocal coach.
Yeah.
So that is an interesting thing to point out. Okay, here's why I bring this up, though. It's not that I'm concerned for myself about these weird feelings I have for Eddie Money. It has more to do with, A, the fact that as he aged, I find it, I just always found it very hard to imagine him as being attractive because he just started to really look like a stereotypical middle-aged guy from Long Island.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
But
if you look at those first album covers, he's got that feathered hair, man. He's got the 80s feathered hair.
The 80s hot look.
Yeah.
Shaking. So I saw those and I was like, okay, I get this. I'm reminded when I see these first two or three record album covers. So maybe it's just the thing that he, as he aged, and we know he was into drugs, spoiler alert, you know, that all went away. But I, in the research, found this quote that is just one of, it's harsh. Robert Christgau wrote a capsule review of the first record in 77. Okay? Do we need to give context on Christgau? Just very famous music critic.
You could, if you want to.
Very famous music critic. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, I guess.
And he writes these little capsule reviews. And he wrote this capsule review of that first record. Read that.
Sorry, girls and guys. Live inspection reveals that the sleek stud on the cover and in the ads is as pudgy and sloppy as his voice. He even has jowls.
Oh, my God.
Watch those cheeseburgers, Eddie boy, or you'll never get the caviar. C-.
Dude, that is rough.
The cheeseburger and the jowls. Like, all that's... Yeah, it's
just
kinda
mean.
Yeah.
That's like some pitchfork writing in the 70s.
I met the guys in Teenage Fan Club when I was in college. And
Hearing this story for the first time now?
I didn't get to interview them, but I was in the room and they were talking. Someone said something about critics and it was the singer. And he's like, you know what they say about critics? It's people that were very bad at music. So they decided to... They would write articles about other people's music.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that's great.
One of the best critic takedowns, and this is not a critic takedown that involves music. It involves food. But if you've ever seen the movie Chef, have you ever seen the movie Chef with Jon Favreau?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
One of my all-time favorite movies. And it all has to do with him losing his mind over a critic being unfair to him and his restaurant. And there is an element of that it threads throughout music, right? It's like, what makes you qualified to tell me my music sucks? And that's how I typically feel. I feel like everything is, for the most part, for different people. And so something might not be for me, but it doesn't mean it is terrible, and I'm not going to sit around and pontificate on why it's awful, especially to make fun of someone and their jowls and their cheeseburger addiction.
Yeah. Do you want to hear where my ADD weirdness went? You said Chef, and I was like, you mean...
Chef from South Park?
I was like, you mean Isaac Hayes in the Stax documentary that's on HBO Max right now?
Hey,
Black Moses?
We're still in music, man. Chef? We're still talking music.
That's true.
All right, so this brings up something really interesting. This whole conversation about Eddie, his sex appeal, etc. And that is the level to which Eddie will lean into television for promotion, right? It's 1977. So MTV hasn't happened yet.
Right. That's true.
And so he could live in the space, especially if he's getting reviews like that from Robert Christgau, to where he is really only focused on radio. But that's not what he does.
No. In 77 and 78 alone, he does Top of the Pops, SNL, Midnight Special, and 1, 2, 3, 4, American Bandstand with Dick Clark.
So this is my theory on this. I think there's a Bill Graham thing in effect here. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Like, I mean,
well-connected person.
It's funny because of what a looming presence Bill has, and I alluded to this earlier, has this huge presence over West Coast music from this time period. The name that he gets associated with the most is not Eddie Money, but he was very close to Eddie Money, and he staked a lot of his own career on Eddie Money. And Eddie's made it sound like, you know, Bill got him a lot of his opening slots, got him to the point where he was playing with bands like, I mean, because let's be clear, Eddie played with bands like The Stones, Fleetwood Mac, and other giant heavy hitters. So it wasn't like he was doing the B circuit. Bill got him on the good stuff.
And Bill also gives Eddie his first guitar player,
which
is Jimmy Lyon, which I love to talk about where he ends up. He's on the first two records, including the guitar solo on Two Tickets to Paradise. Mm-hmm. That's Jimmy. All that.
Plus the guitar solo. So that's like the intro, but the solo goes off. If you've not listened to that solo in a while, go check it out.
The thing I like about Jimmy is that he was Tina Turner's lead guitar player on the Private Dancer tour when she went on her basically her big solo tour.
Private Dancer. Jimmy Lyon.
A dancer for money.
Now, this is an interesting point, right? Because Eddie will really only be a vocalist. Like, this was at a certain point, this didn't happen that much, where you have even guys like Billy Joel and Elton John, I mean, they're still playing an instrument, but Eddie is straight up just a singer.
Yeah.
Like, he's not playing guitar most of the time, but he knows how to play some instruments to varying degrees. We know that he plays saxophone, he plays harmonica, he plays piano, but I honestly don't know if he ever played guitar, or if he even knew how. The voice was the instrument, and that's what he focused on.
Yeah, and whether or not he had a traditional sex appeal, you go watch videos of him from the late 70s, and he's captivating.
He's a great live performer.
As a performer.
Yeah. And yeah, you jumped on this earlier. It's like, yes, when you can understand the sex appeal thing when you understand the swagger with which he walks on stage. And he never really loses it. I mean, he starts look, you know, like an older dude, but there is a confidence that he portrays, even when he's in this paste video singing with these two guys with acoustic guitars. His investment in the live show, he says this is something that he learns from Bill Graham. And in that acoustic performance that I'm talking about that's on YouTube, he's doing this Carnival Barker style vocalization where, like, there's nobody in the room, but he's like, yeah, baby, you know what I'm talking about. It's, you know, he's like talking through it the whole time. And you can see, like, okay, this is clearly this dude's thing. Like, this is the Eddie Money flavor.
Yeah. Now, to hear Eddie tell all this about sex appeal, he's agreeing with my assessment, which is Eddie was having sex. This is a quote from Eddie Money, okay? This is the quote. When I got started in the late 70s, there were plenty of women, plenty of vodka, plenty of pot, and a little bit of cocaine. Everything was fun. Let's put it this way. I came to rock, and what happens when you have some success in this business is you end up drinking for free, you get high for free, you snort for free, and there's women throwing themselves at you. I don't think that could be much more of a vanilla statement than I'm a musician, and I do this for this.
Hear me. Yeah. Have sex and do drugs.
Yeah.
Okay. So this gets us right to Ryan's question.
This
gets us to the sniffing of it all.
That's right. The timeline. Here we are. So Ryan, the album Eddie Money, the self-titled record 77, Baby Hold On and Two Tickets to Paradise are on that one, and he just starts hitting the road to support that.
Yeah. He's just constantly touring, and to this point, Life for the Taking, which comes out in 78, is basically done on the road. I love hearing these stories about these bands who hit it, and then they have to write a second record while they're touring, because they're always strange. They have this totally different energy, because now you're doing this thing every day, and you're also starting to hate it as much as you love it in some ways. So it creates this weird thing. in the album art, I love this. Like, I had never noticed this until I saw it pointed out, and I was like, oh, yeah. So they basically took the album art from the first record, and they recreated it, but they made Eddie look just really tired and sad.
Which is crazy. He puts out Playing for Keeps in 80, and then hits the road again.
Yeah, more touring. Here's a quote. But things changed around the time of my third album, Playing for Keeps, in 1980. That album cost me $500,000 to make with producer Rod Nevison. It was lights out during that period of time because the guy was out of his frickin' mind. And so was I. And after that album, I became very despondent and disappointed with everything.
By the way, if you'd like to make a record with Ron Nevison, I looked it up. You can. He's got a website.
Really?
And you can, yeah, you're like, I thought you went and looked at it too, dude. You can. It like it says like upload your Pro Tools or MP3 files here. Like,
bro, are we gonna make a record with Ron Nevison? We need to talk about how bad. Okay, this is another name like Judy Davis.
Right. So do you want to? So here I can just.
Yeah, run us through this, why this is impressive.
It doesn't mean that all of these records are awesome, but there's
some of them are, though.
There's a pedigree of things here, and I'm not getting all of them. So there's Who's Quadrophenia is a huge deal.
Hell yeah.
Survivor's Vital Signs.
It doesn't suck.
No. Heart's self-titled commercial Gloss Fest with All I Want to Do Is Make Love to You, What About Love, and okay, These Dreams.
Listen, there's a reason it was 85. A hit, and a lot of it is the production. So let's hats off to our boy.
And MTV, for sure. And then Ozzy's Gloss Glam Fest with the second record with Jakey Lee, which is The Ultimate Sin.
Yeah.
Kiss's incredibly cheesy Crazy Nights record that Paul Stanley pretty much wrote like all himself, and Motley Crue reference Vince Neil's first solo
record.
We got
Kiss and Motley Crue back to back on that one.
Yeah, and it's Vince's solo record, which, by the way, that single on that record was called You're Invited, But Your Friend Can't Come.
You're invited? U-R-I-N-E.
Is it You're in Town? You're Invited, But Your Friend Can't Come. So, but we should have a Crew sound effect every time I do this.
We should do that. Why have we not done that? 200 episodes. Why have we not done that?
And let's make it to where the sound effect is something where it's just a nonsense thing where it's Vince going,
I was
going
to say, it's got to be Vince Neil making a noise. That's the only thing that makes
where
sense.
It's like the actual lyrics of like Wild Side, but he's like saying like,
all right. Here we go. All right, we got to get that ready on a hot button. We'll use that all the time.
Oh, yeah. Ron, he was an engineer on Led Zeppelin's Physical Graffiti and Continue.
I like how you just put that at the end. Yeah, you were just like, let me talk about these unimportant albums and Survivor, and then let me talk about this.
And talk about a record that I'm assuming was probably part of it was recorded at Headley Grange, like in a house, and there was a frickin' truck, like the Rolling Stones truck, was outside, and they were running XLR cables like out to the truck outside. Like, that is a record being written on the road.
So when you read about all that Ron Nevison has done, Eddie Money's name is never on that list. This is like the Judy Davis thing. You've got Streisand, Sinatra. Usually you don't hear Eddie Money. You've got Led Zeppelin, The Who. Usually you don't hear Eddie Money. And I didn't find much about Ron having a drug problem, which is sort of what I think Eddie is saying here, is that Ron was really wild to be around. But regardless of that, Eddie, whether or not Ron did, had definitely had some drug problems around this time.
Do you mean Ron was in the music industry in the 80s and we're trying to determine whether he had a drug problem? Here's another awesome quote from the man of the hour, the money man, Eddie Money.
The money man!
So I did blow, and then I did more blow, and then more blow to come down. Then I'd be drunk, and I'd do more blow to get back up, and then the whole thing got to be a nightmare. And sometimes my voice would start going out on stage, and I'd tell the guys in the band to tune down to D, which is a whole step, if you don't know, from guitar. As everything's in standard E, it's a whole step down.
So you got to get lower.
So he can get lower. So he said the guys would be playing rubber bands on their guitars, which is funny. It was a crazy time. I remember staying at the Chateau Marmont and hanging out with Belushi and Ricky Lee Jones, spending money like it was coming out of my asshole. That's a real quote from the money man.
Larger than life, as we have already noted. Yeah. Larger than life, Eddie Money. I have a question. Do you think he did cocaine?
When should I drop one of these stories in now? Just one? Do we drop this story in? I don't know.
Well, okay, we'll get into this a little later when the reality show comes up. Right. But you get the sense that Eddie Money couldn't hold on to money. Like, he really was Eddie No Money. And right. In this period, I think he's spending all that money on drugs.
Right. And to Ryan's letter, we know Eddie is having fun, but we can assume at some point he tries laundry detergent.
So, I mean, maybe, right? Like, I guess we could say he probably tried laundry detergent. Why Ryan knows about it, and there seems to be no record of it anywhere else, I don't know. Somebody's dad was a roadie and knew somebody else, and there's uncles, aunts, sisters, cousin.
But I mean, we've got Eddie Money stories ourselves.
We've got Eddie Money stories, too. Yeah. So, I guess we could assume, but here's what I want to do. We can say, did he try to snort laundry detergent at some point? Maybe so. Instead, what he does know is that he snorted something much, much worse one time.
All right, sports fans, here's the part in the podcast where everything kind of slowly turns as we start to go somewhere else. He gets very drunk one night and wants to do cocaine.
And this will become a talking point in interviews for the next almost 40 years. But he never gets super specific in what I can find as to what actually goes down. So there's not a lot of detail of, like, I was watching TV, I was doing this, somebody made me mad, we were working on this record, and I got tired. Like, none of that. He just says that one night he wants to do cocaine, can't find cocaine.
And he gets what would basically be not cocaine, which is a synthetic barbiturate, which now we know is fentanyl.
And now, in typical Eddie Money blustering, he will go on to call himself the first rock star to ever OD on fentanyl in a tongue-in-cheek fashion. But this is a real thing that happened.
And obviously, this show isn't here to educate people on drugs, but one thing that gets overlooked when the term overdose is thrown around is what that actually means for an individual.
Right. Okay. So, essentially, I always assume overdose means death, brain damage, heart stopping, something like that, right? But what happens to Eddie is incredibly damaging, but not what I consider stereotypical.
Right. His body shuts off, shuts down for 9 hours as a side effect of what he did. And he's laying on his leg in such a way for so long, for 9 hours, he pinches a nerve in his leg.
Oh, my God.
Read the quote, because it's so freaky.
Quote, I killed the sciatic nerve on my left leg, knocked my kidneys out. Doctors told me I would never walk again.
Here's another quote from Eddie from doing that. Quote, I was in such bad shape that I had to use a walker to go from my bedroom into the music room to write, quote from the Money Man.
Now, an interesting tidbit, talking about rumor and innuendo. I ran across something in passing from a music writer who mentions that he remembers the story being circulated at the time, like in the aftermath of the overdose, as being that Eddie Money had food poisoning.
Yeah. My favorite story, which I've read more than one of them now, after it happened after he passed away, was that people said that they were golfing and they'd be like, I was on the 8th hole and I ran into Eddie Money. And we did a bump in the forest, like back in the woods. Eddie Money's like, you want to do a bump? Like, and while they're playing golf to a total stranger.
So, okay, you will see this incident when you look around and read about it as having happened in either like 80 or 81, depending on the source. And Eddie has said many times that he had trouble with his mobility for like a year afterwards or more. Like, he literally has trouble walking. So, in the show notes, there is an appearance on the Merv Griffin Show from 1982. Have you seen this?
Yeah, after the show. It's a whole year and a half later.
And you can see him not being able to walk.
Yeah.
So, we do know this is real. They guide him to the chair, and they are holding his hand at certain points.
Right. And this is a year and a half, 2 years after this happened. Now, I want to make sure the context is all clear here. He puts out Playing for Keeps. It does not do well commercially. He gets exhausted, strung out, and he overdoses. And this would be a career killer for a lot of people.
Yeah, this, you know, a lot of times this is the end. Obviously, he comes back. He doesn't stop making music. Even like he doesn't stop for very long at all. Like usually, you know, you might have a 4 or 5 year gap, right? Like there's a little bit of time here, but it's not crazy. Eddie's narrative later will be that he actually uses his newfound appreciation for life to write this new record. And this one is aptly titled No Control.
And this is the one that has I Think I'm in Love and Shaken. Oh, 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 oh. Which has my favorite line, Stick a clues off.
Is that your favorite Eddie Money song, Shaken?
No, Two Tickets to Paradise is my favorite song. But Shaken, once I found out like Shaken was happening, I wondered what Shaken was about. I didn't know if it was like the bed from Vacation that you put money in the bed and the bed shaken, or the house is a rockin', don't come a knockin', or whatever that. All those things were in my head as a kid, and I didn't understand what that was.
You're making me think of a spiritual sequel to Shaken, which is called Shaking, by the band Sugar Cult on their excellent
and
underrated third record that is called Lights Out. And it is that song is about having it's about having sexual relations. I didn't know if you knew that. I think that's what Eddie Money's song is about too. But
I didn't know. Man, I forgot about Sugar Cult. By the way, everybody,
I love that band.
Sugar Cult is a great band.
Great band. First album's pretty pop punk. Second album, sort of the bridge into this rock album that is their third album, Lights Out. And Lights Out is a dark, gnarly record of sad men who are nearing middle age, and it is great. Chef's kiss. Go check it out.
Are they the I'm Bouncing Off the Walls Again band?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's the first record. That's like the pop-punk record. Yeah. And then after that, it gets increasingly darker. And then Tim Pagnotta, who was in that band, goes on to produce a bunch of rock and roll and pop records that you've heard now. So, you know, one of those stories. Okay, so back to Eddie Money. Shaken is a great song. And this helps him resurge a bit, right? He's not out of the woods, though. In 1983, he releases a record called Where's the Party?
Where's the Party?
Stylistic changes here. He tries to get a little more crooner, a little more R&B, as we've talked about. I don't know if you remember us telling you, his vocal coach, same person who helped Frank Sinatra. So it's his lowest charting effort to date. Nobody wants that crap. And essentially, people start to sort of write him off.
And that
he's done.
Includes his record company. So that includes Columbia.
That's what you don't want. You know, mom can write you off, your neighbors... They can write you off. Your kids can write you off.
Yeah, but you don't want the record company.
You don't want the record company to write you off.
That's where the advance comes from, for you to buy all that cocaine, that wonderful Colombian cocaine. Columbia doesn't want to drop him, but they're worried about his creative decisions, so they take control away from him. So one day, Richie Zito, who's a producer and a guitar player who has another great background, who is on tons of other records, he shows Eddie this song that's called Take Me Home Tonight.
Now, on the show before, we've talked about this idea of interpolations, right? Interpolations. These are snippets of old songs weaved into a new song, right? Yeah. So it's not a sample because it's not the original recording. It's not a cover because it's just a piece of the old song. It's an interpolation. Now, when they play this song for Eddie, he's not a big fan, except he really likes the interpolation in the middle of it because it's a snippet of a song by the Ronettes called Be My Baby.
Right. By the way, Eminem has a song that does this with Steve Miller's Abracadabra. And Steve Miller is ecstatic. He is. He's ecstatic at how it was used.
I always get confused when people are like, I don't like that they're using my stuff. I'm like, this has been a thing in pop culture for 40 years. You should be thrilled that someone has generations removed from you thinks it's good enough to use again. Like, let's be excited about that. You're getting paid.
Yeah. So, Eddie, when talking about this song, says, I will do this song, but we have to get Ronnie Spector herself to sing that part. And Columbia tells him that that's impossible.
Yeah, they say, no freaking way is that going to happen, Eddie Money. Do you know anything about Ronnie Spector? And so Eddie says, fine. And he calls a friend of his, Martha Davis, from a band called The Motels. You might remember them.
Yeah.
And she's going to do the duet with him.
But Martha hears it and tells Eddie, seriously, you should just try to reach out to Ronnie yourself and see if she'll do it.
Okay, so obviously the history of Ronnie is its own episode.
Right.
And we haven't done, and I apologize. But know that, A, she was Phil Spector's muse and for a while his wife. B, it seems pretty certain that she was abused in multiple ways by Phil Spector. during that relationship, and C, by the mid-80s, had faded into some obscurity. Now, her last real attempt at the limelight had been a 1980s solo record that had not done well.
And this story, guys, is so interesting. So, Eddie's always up for a challenge. He wants Ronnie Spector on this record. This is his account of calling Ronnie Spector at her house. Quote, "I could hear clinking and clanking in the background." She said, "I'm doing the dishes, and I got to change the kids' bedding. I'm not really in that business anymore, Eddie. Phil Spector and all that, it was a nightmare." And I said, "Ronnie, I got the song that's truly amazing, and it's a tribute to you. It would be so great if you did it with me."
And she does it. And it becomes music history.
And it's a smash.
It's a smash hit. Ronnie's going to perform it on Letterman with Eddie, and it will give her the courage and the audience for another solo record before the 80s end.
Yeah, and this song becomes a big part of Eddie's legacy, too. Eddie will basically spend the next 35 years openly embracing those first 10 years of his career, playing these old songs and continue to find ways to appear larger than life at The Money Man.
And we keep saying The Money Man because that's how he refers to himself, and we know that firsthand. A couple of stories come to mind. We said we had personal stories about Eddie Money.
Yeah.
One of them is that we had friends in radio who went to CRS one year. And CRS is Country Radio Seminar. Do they still call it that?
I think so.
So basically it was like this summer camp idea where like they bring all the radio people together and they bring all the artists together and they mingle them. So this is why people always say, like, "Bro, you worked in country radio." I'm like, country radio was way more fun than most other formats because the artist relationship with radio was so closely knit.
And for a little while it was the writers. And so CRS, there was, you would get to go and meet writers,
all the people writing the songs too, yeah,
instead of the dudes.
But if you were working something in country, especially if you were coming from another format and trying to break into country, you would go to CRS because you'd meet all the radio people. And so there was a brief period of time where Eddie Money was trying to make it as both a radio personality and maybe a country musician.
He was, I remember the radio personality
very
part.
Briefly, like, yeah. And I think it was with a company that we worked for.
That's
they,
true.
They hired him for about 3 months and then fired him.
Yep.
But at some point during all of this, he goes to Country Radio Seminar with two of our buddies. Murdoch and I are not, but our buddies are, and they come back with a tape. And they're like, and one of the things you have to understand this about radio, and this is like a weird thing to explain, but you know, like when you used to listen to the radio back in the day and you'd hear somebody, you'd be like, "Hey, this is John Bon Jovi and you're listening to," you know, and they'd give the call letters. That's called a liner. Okay. So you would hand a piece of paper to an artist and you'd say, "Hey, will you do this liner?" And then ideally you play that right before a John Bon Jovi song or whatever. And so they're like, "Oh, Eddie Money, will you cut some liners for our we have a classic rock station. So even though you're a country radio personality or whatever you are now, will you do these liners?" And so I wish I had a copy of this tape. Do you remember listening to this tape?
I remember the tape, but I don't remember how.
I mean, it's just Eddie clearing his throat and recutting the liners over and over.
Over and over.
And he's like, "Hey, it's Eddie Money, the money."
It's like if Krusty the Clown was a real person, but Eddie Money, but had a lot of trouble doing
a good description.
But has a lot of trouble doing the voice work. Other than like if you ever see Krusty, like he's in and out in like 10 seconds. Hey, it's Sideshow Mel. Like he's in and out.
Eddie couldn't do it with any speed.
But it's like if Eddie had like a you know, acid reflux.
So that made us laugh. And then I believe it's a few years later, right? That Eddie Money comes to town. And Murdoch is in charge of staffing a meet and greet, which is, you know, when you send listeners to meet an artist in person.
Yeah. And I have an infant.
Oh, yeah. This is that long ago.
So I didn't go. So I have people on site doing this who I'm having to talk to. It's pouring down rain. Like,
oh, yeah, because they delayed the show. I was like, there was something that was keeping the show from happening.
It's not only that they delayed the show because it was raining. People left and people got upset because it was raining and muddy. And, like, it was outdoors, and so it was just a drag or whatever. So Eddie is missing this curtain call time of coming out of his trailer to meet people who have won a contest at a radio station that Brian and I work at, and we have a part-time employee there with interns hanging out, waiting on Eddie Money to walk out of a trailer to meet people, which he does eventually, and comes out of the trailer and goes, "Who wants to meet the money man?
Who wants to meet the money man?"
And he like 100% like is like he it's like the Got Milk commercial, like the blow is like right below his nose, on his lip, directly from our employee told us that story.
Well, and if you in the research, it will be said, depending on how generous the journalist is, that Eddie struggled with drugs his entire life. Now, a lot of people will say that he was clear and clean at like 2003 on. I don't think that was true, not just from this story, but I've read other things that say he goes back and forth. Like, he has large periods of sobriety. So not the point of that story is more to point out how larger than life he was all the time, referring to himself as the money man, busting out of his trailer saying, who wants to meet the money man? I mean, that's hilarious.
I mean,
this is not to disparage. So, you know, I just want that to be clear. We're not here to disparage.
If you own that and like you can walk out, who wants to meet the money man? Like, I mean, you're
it's unbelievable like, stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you're owning it.
Unbelievable. Okay, so, you know, just 6 years ago, just to put a bow on this whole thing about him being larger than life, Eddie signed up himself and his family to be on a reality show on Axis TV. Did you ever see this thing?
No, but I love Axis TV.
It was called Real Money, and I went looking for full episodes of it. All I could find were trailers. No full episodes that I can find on the internet. I'm sure they're there somewhere. So if you find them, send them to us. But they weren't easy to find.
What happened, too, with this show is that while he was filming it, Eddie found out that he had cancer of the esophagus. That's what he had during 2019.
And again, seeking always to be larger than life, he'll announce his diagnosis on the show. And then he will basically live out the last months of his life on TV. The episode in which Money talks about the diagnosis is one day, like it airs. So, I mean, they shoot it and then there's like a lapse time. It will actually air. And then the next day is when he dies.
Yeah. Which is crazy that happened that quickly. A year after he dies, this was from research that you pulled, I didn't know. Eddie Money's family filed a lawsuit against Keck Hospital in the University of Southern California, where he was receiving treatment for medical malpractice and wrongful death in December 2020, saying Eddie did not receive proper treatment for his condition and that he had been neglectedly, recklessly, and carelessly examined and diagnosed.
And now, resolution on this lawsuit, I was not able to find, so it makes me think it's still floating out in the court somewhere. But
yeah, and there's a tribute concert that they had for Eddie Money where all these people that liked him and or knew him came and played his songs, and it is so worth watching because Sammy Hagar is in it. James Hetfield from Metallica.
Huge heavy hitters. Like, he influenced so many people, and I think we think of him as the guy, like, my radio career early on, I was playing, you know, 4 or 5 Eddie Money songs every day, right? Like, that's, I think of him as this guy relegated to adult contemporary radio, right?
But think about
it. He was a rocker?
Think about if you're in the Bay Area and you're in Metallica and you know who Eddie Money is?
You know who Eddie Money is.
Like,
yeah.
That's got to be wild. A party that I would have wanted to go to.
That's wild. Yeah. Well, Ryan, thank you for the question. It led us to talk about a guy who I feel like we've been neglecting. We needed to give some serious time to the money man. If you have any stories about Eddie, if you met him in the woods on a golf course or, you know, at a trailer outside his show, if you've got anything you want to add to the show or questions you want us to answer, remember, you can do that. It is easy. We are the story guys at gmail.com. That's how Ryan got to us. That's how you can get to us. Also, patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. That's how you support the show with a little bit of dinero. And instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. You can interact with us on the daily, see clips of the video, etc. And at youtube.com/rockandrollbedtimestories, you can find our live studio feed. So not every episode, but quite a few episodes up on YouTube as well. And, you know, we have faces for radio, but if you're willing to take the risk, you can check us out. Like this right here. We love that. So Murdoch, until next time, What should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.